added years to the life of the British Empire. What Tennyson was to Lord Raglan's Lancers, William Barrett Travis was to the defenders of the Alamo, besides being their leader and the hero of their tale. The South Carolina native and Alabama emigre earned the rare distinction of memorializing in words the role he then immortalized in the flesh. Travis's letters from the Alamo must stir the soul of the most jaded cynic. To the people of Texas and all Americans in the world, I am besieged by 1,000 or more of the Mexicans under Santa Anna. I have sustained a continual bombardment and a cannonade for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrison are to be put to the sword if the fort is taken. I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly over the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat. Knowing what happened to Travis, the reader, especially if a devoted Texan, can hardly escape a shudder of vicarious complicity in his demise, which makes his appeal for help the more poignant. I call on you in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character, to come to our aid with all dispatch. The enemy is receiving reinforcements daily and will no doubt increase to 3,000 or 4,000 in 4 or 5 days. If this call is neglected, I am determined to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due his honor and that of his country, victory or death. Travis's words have tugged at the conscience of Texans for 7 generations. Yet, neither his gallant prose nor the desperate bravery of the garrison at the Alamo can alter the fact that the battle there was an exercise in martial folly. The battle should never have been fought. And regardless of what the defenders contributed to the mythology of Texas, their contribution to the strategy of the Texas Revolution was nil or negative. For months after the outbreak of the Revolution, at Gonzales in October 1835, the Texas rebels debated the importance of San Antonio de Bayor. The first commander of Texas forces, Stephen F. Austin, argued in favor of an attack on the town, which was still in Mexican hands, but his lieutenants and the rank and file besieging the place adamantly refused. Had the Texas Army at this point been anything more than a gaggle of irregulars, jealous of their right to do as they pleased, Austin might have ordered an attack. As it was, he gnashed his teeth while his men sat still. I have at various times submitted the question of storming the fortifications to a council of officers, Austin complained to his brother-in-law, James Perry, and they have uniformly decided against it. Yesterday I was in hopes the army was prepared to do it, and I issued a positive order to storm at daylight this morning. But on trial I found it impossible to get half the men willing for the measure, and it was abandoned from necessity. Not least because his men wouldn't follow him, Austin was replaced in command by Sam Houston, whose military stature and physical stature, in those days the two weren't unrelated, much surpassed Austin's. Houston was in the process of eclipsing Austin as the great man of Texas, and as on many subjects he disagreed with Austin regarding the importance of Bayor. Houston considered the town hardly worth fighting for, and certainly not worth sacrificing for. It was too far from the American settlements in Texas, and too close to the population centers of Mexico. Its people were too friendly to the Mexican government, and too suspicious of Anglos. The war for Texas independence would never be won at Bayor, but it might be lost there. The proper line of defense of the American settlements was the Guadalupe River, where the rebels could count on a sympathetic populace and secure lines of communication. Yet, Houston was as hopeless as Austin before the recalcitrance of his men. Besides, to order a withdrawal from San Antonio would risk appearing defeatist, which would make controlling the troops even more difficult. So Houston tried to talk to the Texans back from Bayard, tactically holding out the prospect of a later return. Writing to James Fannin, the captain in charge of the forces before Bayard, Houston requested a reconsideration of the siege, which in any event was leaking badly. Would it not be best to raise a nominal siege, fall back to Labaye and Gonzales, leaving a sufficient force for the protection of the frontier, furlough the balance of the army to comfortable homes, and when the artillery is in readiness, march to the combat with sufficient force and at once reduce San Antonio? Houston added, "The army without means ought never to have passed the Guadalupe without the proper munitions of war to reduce San Antonio. Therefore, the error cannot be in falling back to an eligible position." But the army ignored Houston as it had ignored Austin, albeit with opposite effect. When Ben Milam, incensed at some personal ill treatment by the Mexican government, volunteered in early December to storm San Antonio single-handedly, he shamed 300 volunteers into following him. The four-day battle was the longest and most evenly balanced of the war. But finally, the Texans, minus Milam, who was killed by a bullet through the brain, succeeded in expelling the Mexican forces. It was a brave victory, but what it won the Texans was hard to say. The Mexican capitulation included an agreement by General Martin Perfecto de Cos to evacuate Texas. Only the most optimistic of the Texans, however, thought that this single battle had decided the war. A larger Mexican army, likely commanded by Mexico's most famous general, President Antonio López de Santa Anna, would return, probably at the beginning of spring. This larger army was one Houston had to fight, and he sought the most favorable ground for doing so. The victory at Bayard hadn't changed his thinking on the strategic unimportance of the town, but it did complicate a retreat to the Guadalupe. Those who had risked their lives for Bayard wouldn't withdraw simply because Houston told them to. As volunteers and stubborn individualists, they heeded their own judgment and ambitions. Yet that judgment and those ambitions might work in Houston's favor. Bored with guarding Bayard, many of the volunteers succumbed to what Houston derisively called Matamoros rage and headed south, intending to sack the town on the Rio Grande. By mid-January, Bayard's garrison numbered only about 70, a shadow of the force that had captured it. Houston hoped to erase even that shadow and nominated James Bowie for the job. "Colonel Bowie will leave here in a few hours for Bayard with a detachment of from 30 to 40 men," Houston wrote from Goliad to Henry Smith, the provisional governor of Texas, on January 17th. "I have ordered the fortifications in the town of Bayard to be demolished, and if you should think well of it, I will remove all the cannon and other munitions of war to Gonzales and Copano, blow up the Alamo, and abandon the place." But Houston couldn't control Bowie any better than he controlled the rest of the army. When Bowie reached Bayard, he discovered that the remnant there had been busy. Green Jameson, the chief engineer under Commander James C. Neal, had converted the old mission compound into what he proudly called Fortress Alamo. Jameson acknowledged that the garrison needed more men, but in light of recent intelligence regarding Santa Anna's movements, perhaps not so many as to be out of the question. "We heard of 1,000 to 1,500 men of the enemy being on their march to this place," Jameson declared. "In case of an attack, we will move all into the Alamo and whipped 10-1 with our artillery. Such confidence was infectious, and Bowie, whose experience at arms consisted mainly of a skirmish with Mexican forces near San Antonio, some Indian fighting, and an infamously bloody brawl on the banks of the Mississippi, caught the fever. Going over Houston's head, he wrote to Henry Smith to second Jameson's judgment that the Alamo should be defended. The salvation of Texas depends in great measure in keeping Béjar out of the hands of the enemy, Bowie declared. It serves as the frontier picket guard, and if it were in the possession of Santa Anna, there is no stronghold from which to repel him in his march toward the Sabine. Like most of his fellow rebels, Bowie took orders as recommendations, and now he disregarded Houston's directive entirely. Colonel Neal will and myself have come to the solemn resolution that we will rather die in these ditches than give it up to the enemy. These citizens deserve our protection, and the public safety demands our lives rather than to evacuate this post to the enemy. Bowie's connection to Béjar was stronger than most of the Texans, as he had married into the family of Juan Veramendi, a leading Béjarano, and had actually lived in the town. But even Bowie's professed concern for the citizens rang hollow. While he and Neal and the others might conceivably hold the Alamo, they could never defend the town against the force Santa Anna was bringing. If anything, by making the town a battle zone, they endangered those they said they wished to protect. Houston had no recourse against this ill-conceived and disingenuous judgment. Even had he exercised iron control over the army, he would have had difficulty denying Bowie and the others at San Antonio the right to take a stand for Texas. Generals often fret over how to make their men fight. Houston had the opposite problem, how to keep his men from fighting. His predicament wasn't helped by the squabbling that continued to afflict the provisional government. Smith and the general council couldn't agree on the smallest matters, let alone where the defense of Texas ought to begin, and without the support of the civilian officials, Houston couldn't enforce his views regarding military strategy. As a result, the decision to defend the Alamo, like nearly every other decision in the war, was made by those who would have to carry it out. But they needed help. From the beginning to end, the defense of the Alamo was premised on the reinforcement of the garrison there. Every few days, Bowie, Jameson, or Neal wrote to Houston, Smith, or the council pleading for help. Relief at this post, in men, money, and provisions, is of vital importance, and is wanted instantly, Bowie told Smith. Our force is very small, only 120 officers and men. The latest intelligence from the Rio Grande indicated that Santa Anna had more than 5,000 men. It would be a waste of men to put our brave little band against thousands. In answer to the pleas, Smith ordered Lieutenant Colonel William Travis to join Bowie and the others at the Alamo. Travis was skeptical at first, sensing that no one besides Bowie and those already at Béjar was serious about defending the place. Travis asked for 500 men to accompany him. Smith said he could have 100 and would have to raise those himself. Travis managed to muster fewer than 36 provisioned from his own pocket. I must beg that Your Excellency will recall the order for me to go to Béjar in command of so few men, he wrote Smith from the Colorado River. I am willing, nay, anxious, to go to the defense of Béjar, but, sir, I am unwilling to risk my reputation, which is ever dear to a soldier, by going off into the enemy's country with such little means, so few men, and with them so badly equipped. Smith, however, was more intent on fighting his enemies in the provisional government than on fighting the Mexicans, and he neither recalled the order nor increased the resources available to Travis. Perhaps deciding that his reputation as a soldier would suffer more from refusing this assignment than from complying, Travis reluctantly headed off to San Antonio with his small company. "I shall march today with only about 30 men," he told Smith. He wasn't hopeful. "Our affairs are gloomy indeed. The people are cold and indifferent. They are worn down and exhausted with the war, and in consequence of decisions between contending and rifle chieftains, they have lost all confidence in their own government and officers." Travis's gloom persisted after his arrival at San Antonio on February 3rd. As a lieutenant colonel, he ranked below Neal, who nominally commanded the entire garrison, but in reality controlled only those soldiers who had enlisted in the regular army or the organized volunteers. About half the garrison was made up of individuals who had never enlisted in anything and who followed Bowie, a man after their own independent hearts. Bowie got along with Neal but refused to defer to Travis, who inherited the regular command when family illness called Neal away. The result was a split in the garrison, with the enlisted men heeding Travis and the unenlisted Bowie. "My situation is truly awkward and delicate," Travis complained to Smith, and it was made even more awkward by the fact that Bowie was behaving irresponsibly. "He has been roaring drunk all the time, has assumed all command, and is proceeding in a most disorderly and irregular manner." Only Travis's sense of honor kept him at his post. "If I did not feel my honor and that of my country compromised, I would leave here instantly." Eventually, Bowie sobered up and agreed to share the command with Travis. Although this was hardly less awkward than the situation Travis had complained of, it improved morale. Meanwhile, the approach of Santa Anna encouraged cooperation between the Texas commanders. With fewer than 150 men to face the Mexican general's thousands, neither Travis nor Bowie could afford to quarrel unnecessarily. The one thing the fractious commanders had no trouble agreeing on was the need for more troops. David Crockett, the celebrated hunter, raconteur, and former congressman from Tennessee, who had answered his recent defeat at the polls by telling his constituents that they could go to hell and I would go to Texas, reached Bayar with a small company during the second week of February. Crockett's arrival boosted the spirits of the garrison. His stories relieved the tedium. More to the point, his coming indicated that someone out there knew of the garrison's need. Maybe more help was on the way. Soon the garrison discovered how much more help was needed. On February 23rd, the advance guard of Santa Anna's Army of Operations reached Bayard. Travis and Bowie couldn't tell exactly how many enemy troops there were, but the Texans were so outnumbered that they didn't even consider trying to defend the town. They withdrew at once into the Alamo, and they continued to cry for help. "The enemy in large force is in sight," Travis wrote to the alcalde at Gonzales on the 23rd. "We want men and provisions. Send them to us." On the same day, in one of their last joint statements before Bowie fell incapacitatingly ill, Travis and Bowie appealed to James Fannin, now the commander at Goliad. "We hope you will send all the men you could spare promptly. We have but little provisions, but enough to serve us till you and your men arrive. We deem it unnecessary to repeat to a brave officer who knows his duty that we call on him for assistance." As the burden of command fell on Travis, he grew into his authority in a way that must have surprised those who had known him as a young hothead with a checkered past. He had always been glib. Now he became eloquent. He had been belligerent. Now he was resolute. On February 24th, the day after the joint appeal to Fannin, he penned his moving letter to the people of Texas and all Americans in the world. To Sam Houston, Travis wrote another letter, hardly less eloquent, begging for help. "I have every reason to apprehend an attack from Santa Anna's whole force very soon, but I shall hold out to the last extremity, hoping to secure reinforcements in a day or two. Do hasten on aid to me as rapidly as possible, for us to keep them out much longer." Yet, relieved or not, the garrison would fight till the end. "If they overpower us, we fall a sacrifice at the shrine of our country, and we hope posterity and our country will do our memory justice. Give me help, O my country." The response to Travis's pleas was either disgraceful or realistic, depending on one's view of his situation. Fannin half-heartedly attempted a rescue, setting out from Goliad with 300 men and 4 artillery pieces in ox-drawn wagons. But one of the wagons broke down, and then crossing of the Guadalupe went badly, and Fannin and his officers decided that the rescue mission was imprudent and gave it up. Sam Houston didn't even do that much. Precisely what Houston did do during the month of February is impossible to reconstruct, but it had no connection with the battle that was about to take place in the west. He journeyed in the opposite direction, toward Nacogdoches, to drum up support for the political convention that would meet in early March at Washington on the Brazos, and to arrange a treaty of friendship with the Cherokees. Perhaps Houston wanted to put as much distance as possible between himself and the debacle that was taking shape at Bear. He had tried to prevent it, but no one would listen. He didn't wish to be saddled with the blame. During the first few days of the siege, the defenders might have fought their way out of the Alamo, had they so chosen, but their prospects on the plains beyond the fort against Santa Anna's cavalry were poor, and by the end of February they were clearly trapped. The only question was whether they would consider their refusal to surrender. According to what became the standard version of the Alamo story, Travis gave the men a choice between fighting and escaping. All who wanted to stay should step across a line he drew in the dirt. The others might try their luck outside the fort. Besides resting on the flimsiest of evidence, this story ignores the fact that escape in any significant numbers was almost impossible. The garrison's odds weren't good inside the fort, but, especially while hope remained of reinforcement, they weren't much worse than the odds outside. Some minor relief did arrive before dawn on March 1st. When a company of 32 horsemen from Gonzales evaded the Mexican sentries and slipped into the Alamo. The reinforcements were hardly numerous enough to shift the balance between besiegers and besieged, but they let Travis know that his continuing pleas for help weren't going unheard, and they raised hope that more might follow. Yet the relief from Gonzales was apparently the last. Doubt remains on this point, as on many touching the final days of the siege, and when the battle commenced before dawn on March 6, perhaps 200 defenders confronted approximately 2,000 attackers. Despite Green Jameson's boast of beating the Mexicans at odds of 10-1, the Texans stood no chance. During the initial phase of the fighting, their cannon and rifles inflicted fearful damage on the advancing troops, but the walls of the Alamo were too low and weak to prevent the most intrepid Mexicans from mounting the ramparts and opening the gates for their fellows, who poured in and crushed the defenders by massive numbers. Less than 90 minutes after the battle began, it was over. For decades, students of Alamo history have refought the battle, debating how many people died there and where they fell. much less attention has been paid to the larger issue of whether it should have been fought in the first place. Questioning patriotic sacrifice is bad form, especially with the powerful words of the dead commander haunting the collective conscience. But sacrifice is not synonymous with good judgment, and in truth, the defense of the Alamo was woefully misguided. Houston was correct that San Antonio had little significance for the defense of the Texas settlements. Even if Travis and the others had held the Alamo, Santa Anna might easily have left a token force to pin them there and sent the main body of his army after Houston and the rest of the rebels. Nor did the delay caused by Santa Anna's insistence on taking the Alamo slow his advance appreciably. Santa Anna spent 2 weeks at Bayard, 2 weeks in which Houston made scant progress in organizing or training the Texas Army. The rebels were no readier for battle in early March than they had been in late February, as Houston's subsequent forced retreat east demonstrated, and they would have been far readier had their ranks included the men killed at the Alamo. Santa Anna's losses at Bayard were considerably greater than those of the Texans, but his army was so much larger that he could afford to be wasteful. The primary result of the Alamo's fall was precisely what Santa Anna intended, the terrorizing of the Anglo settlements in Texas. As word raced east of the disaster at Bayard, the settlers fled toward Louisiana in what was later called, with relieved levity, the Runaway Scrape. Santa Anna had long since decided that the American colonization of Texas was a mistake, which he intended to rectify by removing the Americans. The destruction of the Alamo and the refugee flight it precipitated got the process well underway. The only thing that saved the Revolution, as it really became after the Declaration of Texas Independence on March 2, 1836, was Santa Anna's impatience. Hoping to catch the Texas government, which had joined the flight east, he committed a cardinal sin of invading commanders. He divided his army. And then he allowed Houston, who until this point had shown every indication of retreating clear to the redlands of East Texas, to corner him where Buffalo Bayou joins the San Jacinto River. Houston's victory at San Jacinto had nothing to do with the defeat of the Alamo or the subsequent massacre at Goliad, except that it and Goliad furnished a rousing battle cry and an excuse for a slaughter that matched in ferocity the scale anything the Mexicans had committed. And in fact, the victory at San Jacinto, though an enormous morale booster, neither ended the war nor guaranteed Texas independence. The captured Santa Anna was overthrown in absentia, and the agreements he negotiated with the Texans were immediately disavowed by the Mexican government. Mexico continued to claim Texas for another decade, and in 1842 succeeded twice in reoccupying San Antonio. What finally settled the Texas question was the intervention of the United States, which annexed Texas in 1845 and defeated Mexico in the War of 1846 to 1848. By that time, the Alamo had entered the mythology of Texas. A prime characteristic of the myth is that every sacrifice serves a purpose. The larger the sacrifice, the more profound the purpose. During the Texas Revolution itself, the legitimacy of the rebellion was disparaged by opponents of slavery, who held that the chief purpose of the breakaway was to ensure the future of slavery in Texas. Mexico had outlawed the institution, and by others who judged it a land grab by armed speculators. The sacrifice of the Alamo afforded an emphatic riposte to the criticism. Would the heroes who died there have done so for the base motives ascribed to them by their critics? Hardly. They must have fought and died to secure democracy and individual rights. And so they did, at least some of them, and at least the rights of some people. But whether the Alamo was the proper place to do it is another question entirely. It casts no aspersion on the defenders' courage to assert that they got the answer to this question wrong. If anything, there is a certain sublime nobility in an act that reflects bravery undiluted by good sense, and it is entirely in keeping with everything about the Texas Revolution, and with much that is characteristically Texan, that this military mistake was not the work of ignorant or fatuous commanders, as has typically been the case in history. No, Raglan ordered the Alamo garrison to stand against Santa Anna. The defenders' decision to do so was theirs alone. Texans have long prided themselves on their individuality, including their right to be wrong in their own way. For them, the Alamo is the perfect shrine. Here's an interesting article from the May 2002 issue of Texas Monthly Magazine, entitled "Sharp Shooter." Richard Young knows it takes a lot of practice and a little natural ability to be a proficient cowboy action shooter. By John Morthland. A green and white striped shirt, a red garter belt hugging the right sleeve just above the elbow, cream-colored button-fly pants tucked into black custom-made boots, a battered black cowboy hat. Richard Tequila Young is looking good today at the Regional Range War Tournament at Ten Star Ranch, which sits in the shadow of Enchanted Rock in the Hill Country. And he's shooting even better. The retort from his 19th century replica guns and the sound of ammo hitting metal targets, producing perhaps a dozen bang-plink, bang-plink, bang-plink successions in about 8 seconds. Tequila is the moniker of the 43-year-old Young, an industrial engineer and father of three who lives in Flatonia and happens also to be a cowboy action shooter. Each of the approximately 45,000 members of the Single Action Shooting Society, SASS, SAS, takes a different alias. As cowboy action shooters, the members dress in vintage duds and fire the same kind of single action pistols, rifles, and shotguns that were used in the Old West. Cowboy action shooting is the least competitive of the seven major categories of shooting sports, and it is the only one that doesn't offer cash prizes. Perhaps not coincidentally, it's also the fastest growing category, and arguably the only one with much of a spectator's following. Tequila, who has won 5 world championships in modern shooting, in the modern classification the gun has adjustable sights, while in the traditional the gun has fixed sights, and won overall crown, was unsuccessful in defending his 2001 modern title at the competition in Southern California in mid-April. His 1897 shotgun broke. Prior to that, Tequila had dominated the sport like nobody had since China Camp, a Southern California pharmacist named Dennis King, who won 5 traditional and overall titles in the 80s. Cowboy action shooters compete for fun and fantasy, and on one level represent just another segment of the many Americans who participate in nostalgic, historical reenactments of some sort. Or so it appears. Tequila talks of the Industrial Revolution breakthroughs he studied in college, such as Frederick Turner's time and motion efficiency theory and Henry Ford's assembly line, and how he applies them to his shooting. It quickly becomes apparent that this can also get to be serious stuff in its own way. And it can cost a pretty penny. Tequila figures he spends anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 a year on guns, ammo, clothes, travel, and entry fees. Competitive shooting, which doesn't normally get warm and fuzzy public relations, couldn't have asked for a better ambassador. Tequila, who has been married to his wife Tammy for 21 years, is fresh-faced, polite, and perpetually cheerful. The only hint of a wild streak he exhibits is his SAS name, which, depending on his mood, he'll tell you he took either because he enjoys an evening shot of the stuff with orange juice, or because the cactus from which it is derived symbolizes the Old West. In 1999, when his oldest daughter, Tara, was the high school homecoming queen, he cut back on weekend competitions so that he could perform fatherly duties, such as pulling her float during parades. He's a member of the National Rifle Association and a Second Amendment absolutist. While organized cowboy action shooting is more than two decades old, Tequila first learned about it on a hunt in 1994 when he read a magazine article in a deer blind. "I said, 'This is absolutely wonderful,'" he recalls. "As a child, my highlight was my hair slicked back right out of the shower, sitting in my undies before the TV at 7 on Sunday evening with my double six guns, quick drawing to Matt Dillon." He went to watch a match in nearby Columbus and quickly began procuring replicas of guns manufactured before 1900. Actual pre-1900 guns are too valuable as antiques and can't stand up to the repeated firing of competition. Though he was drawn to the camaraderie and looseness of the competition, cowboy action shooting came naturally, unlike woodworking and marathon running, his two previous hobbies. It didn't hurt that he also had become somewhat obsessive, shooting up to 40,000 practice rounds annually, until the sheer repetition of pointing and shooting came automatically, almost subconsciously. He quickly began winning local tournaments, and in 1996 he became a SAS member and won the Moderns. He finished second overall at the end of trail. The annual World Championship held in Norco, California. Tequila failed to defeat the defending overall champ only because he missed a shot on the last stage, a series of targets, and was penalized crucial points. That performance marked the beginning of the end of California's stranglehold on SAS championships. 2 years later, Tequila took the overall crown. SAS, which was founded in Southern California and is still based there, has roots in Texas. SAS was co-founded in 1987 by Houston area resident Harper Hale, Judge Roy Bean, Cray, who lived in California at the time. Judge Roy Bean and a group of friends had been firing cowboy guns competitively since 1980, and had launched End of Trail in 1982 before starting SAS as a way, Cray says, to get everyone shooting by the same rules. After registering more than 7,000 members in its first 9 years, SAS boomed. "It started out as Western shooting, but now it's turned into a lifestyle thing," he notes. "There's so many closet cowboys out there. About 35% of its members have never shot anything except cowboy action, and another 10% of its members don't shoot at all. In fact, 25% of its members are women. The End of Trail competition has grown from a two-day match of 65 local shooters to a five-day festival, complete with heavy merchandising, live music, and a Wild West show, attended by about 12,000 spectators, many of them likewise dressed in period garb, who watch almost 700 shooters from 35 states and 5 foreign countries. Cowboy action shooting is now almost a $700 million industry, according to SAS research. Through all the growth, the group has retained its original mandate as a family sport, one in which wives and children are also welcome, explains Judge Roy Bean. This is the sandlot baseball of shooting sports. The only thing we're serious about is safety, he declares, a fat stogie sticking out of his white beard as he mans a recruiting table during Range War, the competition at Ten Star Ranch. The other shooting sports are getting so physical, you have to be young to do it. You have to climb ladders, hang from beams, shoot through windows. Winners of tournaments like the Range War take home only a plaque, while End of Trail champs receive a trophy buckle, a special $2,000 bronze belt buckle, and bragging rights for a year. A tournament always concludes with a dressy banquet, where the most flamboyant women have been known to show up in gowns and jewelry worth a combined $25,000. And there are random drawings for guns and other paraphernalia. Cash prizes to winning shooters are banned. Money kills most sports. You're either an amateur or you're not, Judge Roy Bean explains. Tequila is a good example of a world champion. Any other sport, he'd have people following him around. Here, he's setting up targets, helping other shooters, just like everybody else. And he is. At a typical SAS competition, such as the Range War, shooters are divided into posses of 10 and must shoot 12 stages over 2 days. The stages are mock storefronts of Western buildings, such as banks or saloons, behind which several targets are spread out. At each stage, shooters are given scenarios explaining which targets they must hit, in what order, with their three firearms. The person who does so the fastest, without any misses or safety or procedural violations, for each of which time is added to the score, receives one rank point. The second fastest receives two, and so on down through every shooter. Competitors don't know what the rankings are from stage to stage, so they're shooting against only themselves. At the end of the tournament, the lowest score wins. Posses police and score themselves. It's democracy in action, with the most respected shooters and the lowliest first-timers equally responsible for something. Between stages, as he hauls his gear in a child's red wagon, Tequila critiques or advises rival shooters who ask advice, tips his hat to the ladies, introduces himself to the rookies, and backslaps with the veterans. At night, he often passes up a hotel to camp out on the grounds with other shooters, sitting around a campfire debating the history and mythology of the Old West, where Hollywood creations like quick draws, fanning of pistols, and two men facing each other down on the street simply did not happen. When he steps up to shoot, though, Tequila puts on his game face, closing his eyes and visualizing the stage and scenario three times. In competition, he usually shoots at only about 90% the speed of which he's capable, but his hand-eye coordination is stunning. His pauses practically indiscernible as guns sweep from target to target. Everything I do is to try to be as efficient as possible. When I actually shoot the stage, I've already done it three times in my mind, so I simply go through the routine. This allows me to shoot the stage much faster, much safer, and in an expeditious chronological order. No wasted motion. No wasted time. Like a race car, you want to go as fast as you can without crashing. The ultimate goal is to hit all the targets. This is not a game of speed, but a game of concentration, and you have to stay focused through all 10 stages. And nobody makes it look easier or appears to have more fun.
Maynard Dixon's American West. A major exhibition explores the renowned artist's powerful paintings of the land and its inhabitants. By Dana Joseph. Maynard Dixon was born in 1875 in Fresno, California, 10 years before the San Joaquin Valley Frontier Railroad town was incorporated. the son of well-to-do Confederates who left Mississippi after the Civil War and made a home out west, he exhibited an artistic bent from a young age. By 1892, before he was 20, Dixon had made his way to San Francisco to study art, traveling thereafter to Monterey and Carmel with tonalist painter Javier Martinez, visiting Arizona and Mexico, and journeying by horseback round the West with fellow California painter Edward Boreen. A striking interpreter of the American landscape and the country's diverse cultures, Dixon would go on to do everything from illustrate Clarence E. Mulford's Hopalong Cassidy to advocate for the red of the Golden Gate Bridge. But it was his painting that would make him one of the most important figures in American art. Dixon's iconic paintings of the land and the times form the backbone of the major exhibition, Maynard Dixon's American West, at the Scottsdale Museum of the West in Arizona. One of the most comprehensive exhibitions ever mounted on Dixon, including more than 200 works and the easel he painted them on, the wide-ranging show illustrates the artist's deep sense of place in the West. Also featured is important artwork by well-known artists Dorothea Lang and Edith Hamlin, who were both Dixon's wives and companions. There's a modern sensibility to Dixon's style that resonates greatly with artists today. It sets him apart, says Mark Sublett, exhibition curator and author of Maynard Dixon's American West, Along the Distant Mesa. He thought you should focus your energy on trying to be an original voice of American subject matter, and there are artists following in his footsteps, so to speak. Many artists today recognize him as a grandfather of everyone. We talked to Sublett about Maynard Dixon's art and legacy, and the exhibition book that capture them. CNI, congratulations on the new book and the exhibition. What inspired you to do both? Mark Sublett, I've had a Maynard Dixon Museum in Tucson, Arizona for more than 20 years. I'd always felt if I finally had enough new information to add to the body of work, I would write a Dixon book. There was enough knowledge and new things that it was worth the endeavor. The Scottsdale Museum of the West approached me about doing a show, so that was the perfect impetus. What makes Maynard Dixon such a towering figure? There were multiple facets to the man that qualify him as one of our most important American painters who happened to be born in the West. Most Western painters weren't born in the West. The Taos founders, Remington, Russell. The only other one besides Dixon was Edward Boreen. Dixon and Boreen actually painted together. In 1901, they took 10 horses out of Oakland, California, on a 1,000-mile horseback ride to capture cowboys in action. They were hoping to make it to Wyoming and Montana, but the horses broke down, and they had to take the train back to San Francisco. They did all these wonderful drawings of cowboys at work and ranches in Northern California and Oregon. There are examples of these very rare pieces in the show. What's the first time you remember being awed by a Maynard Dixon painting? I'd been interested in his work, and I'd seen it before I decided to do a show of his art in 1996. One of the first pieces was Late Light on the Catalinas, 1943. It was brought in by a dealer who wanted it in the show or to sell it. I ended up falling in love with the painting. I thought, wow, this guy is an amazing individual. I sold the painting in the 1996 retrospective, then bought it back later from the person I sold it to. I still have that painting. It's not in the show, but it is in the book. It's so interesting that he was married to Dorothea Lange and Edith Hamlin, both important artists in their own right. What else might people be surprised to learn about his background? One of the things that set him apart is that he was intimately involved in the building of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. From helping hire architectural engineer Irving Morrow to doing the drawings for what it would look like, and the drawing and paintings that graced the cover of the bond issue that ran in the newspapers that helped to pass the $35 million bond, to the fact that it was Dixon who wrote Morrow and told him, "If you want it to be the wonder of the world, keep it under color of red, not black or a dark color." He also was involved with the Boulder Dam as part of the PWAP, Public Works of Art Project, to go and document the building of the dam. For 35 days in April 1934, he captures the essence of what's going on with man against mountain. During that time, 4 men died, and the hospitals were full of injured dam workers. So he has an intimate look at what's going on in America in some of the largest architectural undertakings of the 20th century. He also does a 2-panel mural for the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the main interior building, the 25x34 oils that were the studies for those murals are in the show. He also wrote poetry. Dixon says, "All my poet friends say I'm a good painter, and my painter friends say I'm a good poet." He was an excellent writer and poet, and in 1923 had a book of his poems published. He starts writing poetry in 1896. His poems are deep examinations of his life, emotions, and feelings he's experiencing in different periods associated with paintings or what our country is like and his own world as it spirals out of control during the Depression, World War I, and divorces from 2 wives. The poems are snapshots, always emotionally charged and beautifully written in script. There are numerous examples of poetry in his hand throughout the exhibit. Dixon's art is pioneering, unique, recognizable. Would you call his work iconic? Yes, his work actually is iconic. Iconic to me means you associate something, whether verbal or visual, with something else. There's a bond, a connection that you experience with Cloud World, 1925, or Earth Knower, 1931, 1932, 1935, a painting of a Native American juxtaposed against huge rocks. You know you're speaking of the West. You have no doubt that this couldn't be anywhere but the West. He is able to evoke an emotion of whatever it is that he's trying to portray. In Earth Knower, the individual is one with the land. Cloud World portrays small riders against a huge landscape. Man is insignificant and just passing through. A lot of his paintings evoke these emotions. Clifford Still's biographer says Earth Knower was an important painting even to an abstract expressionist. He found it to be iconic. What's another piece you'd single out? Dixon himself considered his greatest work Shapes of Fear. That pivotal and important painting is in the show, along with 2 studies. He starts Shapes of Fear in 1930, in the throes of the Depression. It portrays robed figures that are very ominous. Dixon uses the word. He feels like there's a vice around his neck when he's painting, so severe is his concern for what is going on in his world. In 1931, he enters the painting in the San Francisco Art Association's annual exhibition and wins the most popular painting award, the Harold L. Mack, beating out Edward Hopper, Diego Rivera, William Glackens. It clearly struck a chord. In 1932, he enters it in the National Academy of Design show in New York and wins the Harry W. Ranger Award. The $1,500 prize money, he says, saves my life. That award is considered to be the premier painting of that year. Shapes of Fear is the great painting of 1932. The studies for it are in the Maynard Dixon Museum collection. The oil is in the Smithsonian collection. You can see all of them in the show in Scottsdale. Oasis at Death Valley. A historic gem in the hottest place on earth. By Sherry Monahan. People have been winding their way into this oasis since 1927, when it played host to adventure seekers in their new automobiles. It was an exclusive desert escape for Hollywood elites such as Marlon Brando, Clark Gable, and Carol Lombard. The inn has gone through a complete $100 million Renaissance renovation to bring the elegance of old Hollywood back. Today, guests motor up the same way, albeit with air conditioning, and arrive at the mirage-like inn with its swaying palms and serene springs. The inn offers rooms in the original property or in newly built casitas that include personal golf carts. The casitas are suite-like, each with a separate living space and private outdoor seating area. Many of the original rooms at the inn have decorative fireplaces. The Oasis has many of the same things it did in its early days, including swimming pools, dining, golf, and sightseeing. Guests can chill in private cabanas or lounge in the sun by the spring-fed pool that naturally drains and refills 4 times per day. The spring keeps the pool water about 85 degrees year-round. The inn also offers spa services near the pool for guests, massages, aromatherapy treatments, foot baths, and more. The inn pool cafe serves sandwiches, wraps, salads, and assorted beverages so guests can grab a bite without having to stray too far from the water. Golfers can play the lowest game of their lives because the Furnace Creek course sits at 214 feet below sea level. Players are able to pair a drink or quick bite at the 19th hole with outstanding views of the mountains. The inn and its family-friendly sister property, the ranch, serve as good bases for seeing the sights in Death Valley National Park, where desolate beauty abounds. Badwater Basin, Artist's Palette, the Devil's Golf Course, and Zabriskie Point are a short drive away. Guests can begin and end their days with more elaborate meals at the historic upscale dining room at the inn, either inside or outside on the terrace, again for the views. Other options include the Western-style Last Kind Word Saloon, or the 1849 buffet at the ranch. All have well-crafted menus with culinary nods to the area, such as locally sourced dates. At dinner, the inn serves tasty date bread that has been on the menu for decades. There are also blue cheese stuffed dates as an appetizer and creamy date butter and bread at breakfast. Staff will pack an ordered lunch to go for guests who are planning to be out adventuring all day. The Oasis at Death Valley summarizes the experience offered to guests with a bit of clever wordplay. Its tagline is, "In the middle of nowhere, you'd rather be."
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been...
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 69 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.